Well, here are a few words that I bet you never thought you would hear start off a sermon from this pulpit. I want you to imagine for me. The groan. I want you to imagine for me that you are an ancient Israelite wandering around in the desert. It's hot, it's sunny, there's no water anywhere to be found. You're in your sandals and your tunic, and the sand is in your feet. And I want you to imagine that you are walking to the center of the camp. The entire nation is arranged as we sit around one place. And everything about this place says that it is special. And everything about this place says that it is different. This place is roughly the size of this room. I actually was talking to Kevin Weed a little bit, and we kind of figured that this place is roughly the size of this room, and it is marked off by a wall that is tall enough that you can't see over it. You can't see what's going on inside of it. And there is one gate and only one way to get into this place. And this place is at the center of the community, and this place is special, and it is difficult to get to for one reason. That is because the God of the universe is there. Now, sure, we understand that God has power over all things and that he is in all places and that he is omnipresent. But in a very special way that is true of no place else in the world, God dwells there. In fact, as you come to the entrance to this gate, or the gate into the walls, it is very clear what the main event is within that courtyard, within that area. That is a tent that is roughly the size of this stage. If you go from the orchestra pit over to the other side of the piano there, and it's about that long and about as deep as this stage is. It's 45 feet long by 15 feet wide. There is a tent. It's a beautiful tent. It is made of several layers of different fabrics and different leathers and things like that. But that, in that building, in that tent, stands the presence of God. Only one way into the courtyard, only one way into the tent. And there is a message about how the courtyard is set up that tells you something very important about that tent. And that is this, that between you and that tent, as you walk into that courtyard, there is one very large piece of furniture. It's about the size, again, it's about the size of this front, this platform right here where it juts out. It's 7.5 feet by 7.5 feet, and it's 4.5 feet tall. Smoke rises out of it as an altar made of acacia wood that is overlaid in bronze. The message is very clear that there is no way to God except by going through that altar. There is no way to the presence of God except coming by sacrifice. The only way to draw near to him is to bring the sacrifice that is demanded so that you can be set apart from everyday life and worship in the presence of God. In fact, everything about the sacrificial system in the Mosaic covenant that governed the way the nation Israel had to function is designed to tell everyone that if you want to worship in the presence of God, that you must bring sacrifice. In fact, the Hebrew word for sacrifice, all Hebrew words come from a three-letter sort of root, and the root that meant to sacrifice, or the root for the word sacrifice, was the word to draw near. I believe this served a dual purpose. First of all, you're talking about the sacrifice that you bring near to God, and then, more importantly, the purpose of the sacrifice was to be able to draw near to God. And I want to take some time tonight to consider with you those sacrifices and that sacrificial system. Turn to Hebrews chapter 9 here very briefly. We're going to see that only through sacrifice may the worshiper draw near to the Lord. And in the Old Testament system, these sacrifices, the sacrifices that God prescribed in Leviticus 1 through 7, that's where we're going to spend the majority of our time tonight, they allowed the Old Testament people to function in accordance with the law so that God could dwell among the people and the people could worship the Lord. But what we've seen in Hebrews, and Pastor Gill has spent a good deal of time talking about this over the last few weeks, what we've seen in Hebrews is that there is no way for them really to finally remove the effects of sin and finally actually really draw near to God through the blood of bulls and goats, through the blood of these sacrifices. And what we're going to see tonight as we consider these sacrifices is that God designed the sacrifices to work in a way that would explain to us, that would enlighten us as to exactly what the ultimate sacrifice, that is Jesus Christ, would do when he died on the cross. We see that God designed that whole tabernacle system that we've talked about and the whole sacrificial system that we're going to talk about in order to give us a picture of exactly what it takes to worship in his presence. You're in Hebrews chapter 9. Look at verse 8. We see this just so you know that I'm not just making this up and say, oh, this would be a neat thing to do with this Old Testament passage. I want you to see what I'm talking about here. It says in Hebrews 9:8 that the Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. I love that word symbol. The word symbol is the word that we usually translate as a parable. In fact, we've got a picture here of the tabernacle. Stephen, you can put that up. This is what you would have seen. This is a recreation of the tabernacle that is in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. But this is about what it would have looked like. And the reason that God designed the things to work the way that he did was as a living parable. It's to demonstrate exactly what it takes to walk in God's presence. So the way that he has set up the courtyard here, the fact that the altar there is in front of the tabernacle, the fact that the tabernacle and the tabernacle area are completely set apart from everything else, in fact, the way that the furniture is designed and the way that everything is put together with the tabernacle is designed to be a picture of heaven. And not only is the tabernacle a picture of heaven, but we're going to see here, if you'll skip down to chapter 10, verse 4, that the sacrificial system that went on there is also a picture of what Christ would do. Look at Hebrews chapter 10, verse 4. And the whole argument here has been the fact that those Old Testament sacrifices could never really do what Christ finally accomplished. And he says this, "For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Therefore, when he comes into the world, that is Jesus, he says, 'Sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure.' Then I said, 'Behold, I have come in the scroll of the book. It is written of me to do your will, O God.' After saying the above, sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin," you're going to recognize all of those words by the time we're done with tonight. "After saying that those things he has not desired or taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law, he said, 'Behold, I have come to do your will.' And he takes away the first," that is, that sacrificial system in the Old Testament, "in order to establish the second," that is, the new covenant that is going to be established or has been established in the blood of Jesus Christ. "By this will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all." So I want to take a look tonight with you. Turn back to Leviticus chapter 1. And I want to take a look tonight with you at these animal sacrifices in this sacrificial system. And what we saw there in Hebrews is that the New Testament draws a very close parallel between that sacrificial system and the different things that happened in those animal sacrifices and the work that Christ would accomplish on the cross. Now, the theological word that we use for this is called typology. It's called typology. And I want to be clear about what that means. When I say that we're going to examine the typology between those Old Testament sacrifices and the work of Jesus Christ, I'm not saying that we are adding meaning to what we see here in the book of Leviticus. When God instructed Moses what to write down in the book of Leviticus, he was talking about the sacrificial system. We're also not talking about something where the Old Testament Israelites went about their life, and then they came and they gave the sacrifices at the temple or the tabernacle, and they said, "Oh, well, this is going to prefigure what the Messiah will do." No, they understood that if they offered their sacrifices in faith properly, that God would allow them to dwell in his presence according to the Mosaic law. But what a type is something that God orchestrated, probably in the Old Testament time, to function in a way that would picture what actually happened in the work of Jesus Christ. Would actually picture what the spiritual reality of who Christ is and of what he's done. Okay, so we're not adding meaning to Leviticus chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, but what we are doing is we're looking back at what happened in that Old Testament system under the Mosaic law, and we're going to see the picture that it paints for us as we understand who Christ is and what he's done today. Make sense? All right, I'm going to assume, since no one is screaming no, that that is an affirmative answer. So we're not adding meaning, but we're seeing that God has done things on purpose so that they would reflect what Christ would do when he died on the cross. And we understand this relationship between these things because God told us. So what we're going to see tonight in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7 are four sacrificial pictures of Christ's work on the cross. We're going to see four sacrificial pictures of Christ's work on the cross. Now let me make a note about the whole of the text. We're obviously not going to read all seven chapters or all of all seven chapters. But the way this is set up is in chapter 1 through the beginning of chapter 6, the instruction goes through how the Israelites were to bring their sacrifices to the tabernacle, sort of from the worshiper's point of view. In other words, God says, when you bring a sacrifice, worshiper, this is what you're supposed to do. Then he circles back, starting in chapter 6, verse 8, and moving through chapter 7, and talks to the priests about what they're supposed to do and their role in the sacrifices. And there are four sacrifices we're going to see, and the order that we'll take them in are the burnt offering. We're then going to see a sin offering, a guilt offering, and then finally the peace offering. Okay? So just so you know where we're going, much of this stuff is repetitious, being talking about how they're supposed to treat the same sacrifice with different animals. So we'll try to limit mostly to talking about just one animal per sacrifice. So in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7, the first sacrifice we see that is a picture of the work that Jesus Christ would do is a burnt offering that pictures Christ's sanctifying work. Okay, a burnt offering. The burnt offering pictures Christ's sanctifying work in the beginning of chapter 1, and then also sort of in the middle of chapter 6 is where we see the burnt offering. So let's take a look, and there's a pretty regular pattern of what's going on. We're going to take a look at what were the circumstances that you brought each offering, what animals could you bring, then we'll talk a little bit about the process of bringing that sacrifice and what would happen. Leviticus then points out a number of the different results that were intended through the sacrifice, and then we'll talk about how that reflects what Christ would do. So look at Leviticus chapter 1, and we'll see when you brought the burnt offering. This first offering is the burnt offering. And God says, tell the people this, if his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, that is a cow or an ox, he shall offer it a male without defect, and he shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting, that is the tabernacle tent that we generally think of. He shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. So the circumstances of this burnt offering are the most general. If you wanted to come and worship before the Lord, this was the offering that you brought. There's not necessarily a particular reference here to sin or anything like that. But when the worshiper wanted to approach the Lord and to secure his favor, he would bring the burnt offering. The acceptable animals here, there are several. You brought the animal that you brought was based on your financial ability. Not everyone in Israel could afford a bull, a cow, to bring every time that he wanted to come worship at the tabernacle. The most expensive was the bull. The richest in society, those with the most means, would bring that. The sheep or the goat was also acceptable. A male sheep or goat in chapter 1, verse 10, was appropriate for someone of more modest means, someone maybe of the middle class. If you were poor, Provision was also made for you. The poorest in Israelite society were allowed to bring a turtle dove or a pigeon. But the point here is that regardless of your financial status, this offering would be costly. Animals, they still are. But in that day, animals were expensive. And they used animals for a lot of different things. They used animals for milk, for hair, and for shelter, and all sorts of things like that. And if you were going to come and slaughter an animal, that was a loss of a lot of income. This was a costly offering to bring. But if you wanted to come and worship before the Lord at the tabernacle, it was an offering that you were going to have to make. Now let's take a look at what the process of this offering would be. You would bring your animal, and let's pick up in verse 4. He brings the animal before the doorway of the tent of meeting. And the idea there in verse 3 is that he is bringing this before the Lord, before Yahweh. And verse 4 says, he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. And he shall slay the young bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priest, shall offer up the blood and sprinkle the blood around the altar that is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And then he shall skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. And the sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Then Aaron's son the priest shall arrange the pieces, the head and the suet over the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. Its entrails, however, its legs, you shall wash with water. And then the priest shall offer up and smoke all of it on the altar for a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. What would happen here is this: the worshiper would bring the animal to the Lord, to the doorway of the tent of meeting, and he would lay his hands on the head of the animal. Now, this is maybe a little deceiving. We think of maybe laying your hands on it as going like this, and kind of touching it. The idea here is he holds the head of the animal down. What he's doing here is he's identifying himself both as the owner of the offering, and he's identifying himself with the offering itself. He's saying, I own this animal, and I'm bringing it to make offering here, and this animal, what happens to this animal is what ought to happen to me. I'm identifying myself with this animal. And that animal, in this burnt offering, they slay the animal, and this would have been, by the way, an extremely bloody process. You take a cow, and you slit its throat, and what you have to do in order to do this is drain all of the blood out of the cow, and then they have to take the blood, and here on this offering, they're going to pour it all around the altar before you can then cut the cow into all sorts of pieces. And then, this is the key in this offering, by the way. Look at verse 9. The priest shall offer up in smoke all of the offering on the altar. So every last piece of this animal goes onto the altar and it is burned up. If you come over to chapter 6 and look at verse 9, these are the instructions for the priests here. He says, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law for the burnt offering. The burnt offering itself shall remain on the hearth on the altar all night until the morning. And the fire on the altar is to be kept burning on it. The priest is to put on his linen robe. He shall put on the undergarments next to his flesh. He shall take up the ashes to which the fire reduces the burnt offering on the altar and place them beside the altar. And he shall take off his garments, put on the other garments, carry the ashes outside the camp to the clean place. The fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out. But the priest shall burn wood on it every morning. And he shall lay out the burnt offering on it and offer up and smoke the fat portions of the peace offerings on it. And the fire shall be kept burning continually on the altar. It is not to go out. Do you get the emphasis here? This offering, this burnt offering, is consumed to ashes. And the fire of the burnt offering is never, ever, 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 ever to go out. The picture in this sacrifice is that of the offerer being totally consumed and totally consecrated and totally given up to the Lord. When the worshiper identifies himself with this animal and then slays it, he cuts its throat, he bleeds it out, and he throws the whole animal on the altar, he's saying, Lord, I would come to you and worship, and I would be totally consecrated to you. I would be totally and completely set apart to you. And I understand, I recognize, God, that this is what it takes to worship before you. Here are the results of this offering. Look in chapter 1, verse 9. He says, when this is offered up, it will be an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. Now, there are a couple of things that are indicated by this statement, and we'll see this little phrase, a soothing aroma, a couple of times again. First of all, is that this is a pleasing offering to the Lord. It is an offering that he accepts. And it is one that curries his favor. It brings his favor. When the burnt offering was brought with a penitent heart, the offering was accepted by the Lord and it secured his favor. We see in chapter 1, verse 4, that this offering also made atonement. This man shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. That word atonement means to make right in a relationship. It means to cover sin and cover wrongdoing so that we can be accepted in a right relationship with the Lord. And so as this worshiper said, I would be fully set apart to you, God. I would be fully consecrated to you. I would worship in your presence. And I recognize that in order to do that, I must be totally and completely consumed. That is a soothing aroma. It was a pleasing thing in the sight of the Lord. And it made atonement. It made a right relationship between God and the worshiper according to the law. And finally, in chapter 1, verse 3, this is the end game. He brings this offering that he may be accepted before the Lord. This offering, this burnt offering, allowed the worshiper to come before the Lord and worship at the tabernacle. It allowed him to rightly be set apart from the rigmarole of daily life. It allowed him to be set apart from sin so that he could rightly worship in the very presence of God. Now, in New Testament language, we call this being sanctified, being set apart. And here's the lesson that we need to learn from this burnt offering. Here's what the burnt offering tells us. First of all, it tells us that God is holy. And we don't quite, I think, have a proper understanding of exactly what that means today. We think of, yes, holy, he's set apart from sin, and he doesn't sin, and he only does what is righteous and all of that. What the word holy means, especially its connotations in the Old Testament context, is he is different. Not only does God not sin, and not only does God always do what's right, and not only does God dwell in the light and not in the darkness and all of those things, God is totally and completely other. He is not like us. And we cannot worship without being set apart to him, without going where he is. And everything about the tabernacle was set up to indicate that. The courtyard was set off. The holy place was set off from the courtyard. The Holy of Holies was set off from the holy place. And only one person could go in there one time a year where God actually was. And all of this was sanctified ground. It was holy ground. There were certain things that were not appropriate to happen on the temple area, in the tabernacle area. And not even sinful things. Just everyday life could not happen there. It was different. And in order to approach God, you must be set apart from everyday life. The law taught that sin and even contact with the mundane rigmarole of life makes us unworthy of God's presence. All of the laws, clean and unclean regulations, point us to that. Man's greatest need in light of this, in order to approach God, an individual must be totally and completely set apart to him. And as the worshiper identifies himself with the offering and the offering vicariously served to set him apart as it was totally consumed on the altar. I said here just a minute ago that the New Testament language that we use for this idea of consecration really is the idea of sanctification. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5. And we will move a little more quickly with these other sacrifices because we've seen a lot of the ideas that we need to know and understand here just with the burnt offering. But in Ephesians chapter 5, stop at verse 2 first. We see what Christ has accomplished. And this is the context here. I stop at verse 2 because it puts us in a bit of a sacrificial context. Paul says, walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice as a fragrant aroma. Christ offered himself as a fragrant aroma. Now skip down to verse 25. We're talking about the husband and wife relationship and the way that it reflects what Christ has done on the cross. But we have this idea of the fact, and we have revealed for us here, that part of what Christ did when he died on the cross is he set us apart to himself. He consecrated us. He sanctified us. Ephesians 5:25 says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Remember in chapter 5, verse 2, what is this talking about? It's talking about him giving himself as an offering, a sacrifice. So that, why did he do that? So that, Greek guys, here's a henna clause. We just talked about those this afternoon. So that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present her to himself, the church, in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So the burnt offering pictures for us what Christ has done in giving himself as an offering, giving himself as a sacrifice, so that we, when we are identified with him through faith, are identified as being fully set apart, sanctified to Jesus Christ, washed, and worthy of coming into his presence. So we have the burnt offering that pictures the sanctifying work of Christ. Back in Leviticus, secondly, we're going to see the sin offering that pictures Christ's cleansing work. The sin offering that pictures Christ's cleansing work. We're going to see this in chapters 4 and chapter 6. So turn to chapter 4, verse 1. And actually, verse 2 is where we'll pick up. And the key concept here in this idea of the sin offering, where in the burnt offering it was being consecrated, it was being sanctified, being set apart. The key concept here in the sin offering is that it pictures the offerer being cleansed, being washed from the defilement of sin. We see the circumstances in chapter 4, verse 2. Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and commits any of them. We're talking here about unintentional sin. Now, I think it's best to understand that phrase there in the middle of verse 2. Probably best to understand these sins as sins that are committed out of the weakness of the flesh. Sins that are committed because of weakness. The law makes no provision for those who sin high-handedly against God. In other words, who say, I am willfully, high-handedly rebelling against God. God says, do this, so I'm going to shake my fist at him and I'm going to do exactly the opposite. You remember the first example we get in the Old Testament of the high-handed sin is the guy who goes out and he collects sticks on the Sabbath day right after they've been told not to do work on the Sabbath day. And what is the nation instructed to do? They say, God, what should we do with this guy? And God says, stone him. Not because collecting sticks is a horrible, awful thing to do, but because apparently this man was saying, forget God. I got work to do. These sins are not of that type. These sins are sins that someone does because I'm weak, because I've fallen to temptation. Not, oops, I accidentally did this. The other end of this is probably included here, failure to do something that should have been done. He gives some examples in chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Somebody who fails to bear witness when called upon. In other words, when something had happened and they call for any witnesses to come forward and say, I saw this man do this, or I saw who took that, or anything like that. Somebody failed to do that. If someone came into contact with something that was unclean, that is ritually impure, then this was the sacrifice that he needed to bring. If someone swears thoughtlessly, makes an oath, and doesn't take it seriously in chapter 5, verse 4, he was to bring this sin offering. What we're going to see here in this offering is that that person who did these things needs forgiveness from the guilt of sin and cleansing from its defilement in order to be able to avoid wrath and to draw near to the Lord. So if someone has sinned because of the weakness of his flesh, he has fallen to temptation, he has failed to do something that he ought to have done, He needs to bring this sin offering and be cleansed and gain forgiveness for that sin. The acceptable animals here is based on your position in society. The most important people in society, the high priest, or if the congregation as a whole, if the nation as a whole sinned against the Lord, they were to bring a bull without defect. If you were a leader of the congregation, if you were a leader among the people, you had to bring a goat or a sheep, a male goat or a male sheep. If you are a normal person, you were to bring a female goat or a lamb or a turtle dove or a pigeon, or even acceptable to bring fine flour based on what you were financially able to do. And the reason for this sort of graded idea here in this offering is that if you were a representative of the nation, you were held as more important in the nation. And the sin and the defilement that you brought on the nation and brought on all of those things around you were that much more important to be cleansed. If you were the high priest and you represented the people before God, and where did the high priest go that nobody else went? He went to the Holy of Holies, right? And where were the priests able to go? They were able to go into the holy place. And the idea in this offering is that if you have sinned, you carry defilement and contamination with you wherever you go. So not only are you defiled, but the things that you come into contact with are defiled. And thus, it makes those places unworthy of God's presence. The more central you were to society, the more defiling damage you could do, so the more costly the animal. But we see the flip side of this as well, that provision is made so that every single individual, regardless of position in society or financial position, financial wealth, had a sacrifice that was acceptable for him to bring. No matter who you were, you could bring sacrifice. Pick up in chapter 4, verse 4, and let's see what you did and how this sacrifice looked. This individual, whoever has committed this unintentional sin, he shall bring the bull. Here we're going to start off looking at the offering of the high priest. He shall bring the bull into the doorway of the tent of meeting before the Lord, and he shall lay his hands on the head of the bull. Remember, that means that he is identifying himself with this offering, and he shall slay the bull before the Lord. He slit its throat. And then the anointed priest is to take some of the blood of the bull and bring it to the tent of meeting, into the tabernacle itself. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood, and he shall sprinkle some of the blood 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. The priest shall also put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense, which is before the Lord in the tent of meeting. And all the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of the burnt offering, which is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Skip down to verses 30 and 31, and we see what happened with the blood from the offering of the common person. The priest shall take some of the blood with his finger, and he shall put it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering. Now, this is the altar that you bring your offering to. It's outside of the tabernacle. He shall put some of the blood on his finger, put it on the horns of the burnt offering, and all the rest of its blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar. And he shall remove all its fat, just as the fat was removed from the surface of the peace offering. And the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar for a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus the priest shall make atonement, and he shall be forgiven. So the key concept here, the key idea in this sin offering, is the blood acts almost like a holy detergent. We think of blood and we think of it as something as nasty and sort of dirty and grimy. But in the Old Testament system, and we've seen this in the book of Hebrews, that what does blood bring? It brings cleansing, right? It brings cleansing from defilement and from the dirtiness that sin brings. If you were the priest and you sinned, one of the things we see is that the priest had to take the blood and he had to take it into even the holy place itself and cleanse that area. Because if the priest had sinned and gone into that area, he brought defilement to it. If you were a commoner and you had come into the tabernacle area, you had sinned, you brought your sin dirtiness with you, the area of the altar had to be cleansed. Cleansing must happen. Cleansing from the defilement of sin is absolutely necessary to come into the presence of God. And this blood acts like a holy detergent for the temple and its area. Then, unlike the burnt offering, in this sin offering, the priest would just cut out the innards, basically, and the fatty portions, which are considered the choice portions, the best portions of the animal. And those things are thrown on the altar, they are burned up, and it makes a soothing aroma. We see again here that when this offering in verse 31 is given with a penitent heart, it is something that is pleasing to the Lord and is accepted in His sight. And this makes atonement there toward the end of verse 31. It restores the right relationship between worshiper and God. And finally, we see here that atonement is possible because His transgression has been forgiven. On account of the sacrifice, on account of the blood that was shed, on account of the life that was given, there was cleansing that took place from the defilement of sin, and the man's transgression, the man's sin, the man's guilt, the guilt that he had accrued because of his sin will not be held against him by God. Here's the picture of this offering. It is that in sin, we acquire guilt. We acquire the rightful condemnation of God for our offense against Him. And in addition to that, we are defiled. We are dirty before God because of our sin. We are unacceptable in His sight. We are unacceptable to come into His presence. That guilt exposes us to God's wrath, to God's punishment. And that defilement, it disqualifies us from His presence. And we see in this sin offering that man needs to be forgiven. He needs to have his defilement removed. And praise God, it's been done through the work of Jesus Christ. Stick a finger here in Leviticus chapter 4 and look at Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1, I've tried to keep most of the New Testament references fairly close together. Titus chapter 1, verses 15 and 16 outline man's position of defilement. He says, "To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their mind and their conscience are defiled. They are dirty. They profess to know God. They may profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny Him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed." This is us. This is all of us because of our sin. We are defiled, we are detestable, we are disobedient, we are worthless. But we see down in chapter 2, verse 11, that the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires, to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave Himself for us. What is the idea there again of giving Himself for us? It is that He has given Himself as an offering, a sacrifice, to redeem us from every lawless deed and to what? Purify for Himself a people for His own possession, zealous for good deeds. Jesus Christ, in His offering on the cross, He accomplished what this sin offering never really could. He has made those who come to Him in faith pure. He has cleansed us. He has washed us from the defilement of sin. He has taken our guilt upon Himself. He has secured forgiveness for us so that we are not only no longer liable to God's judgment, but we are worthy to come into God's presence because of the work of Jesus Christ. That is what the sin offering pictures about Christ's cleansing work. Let's move quickly along now. The third offering we're going to see tonight is the guilt offering that pictured Christ's recompensing work. The guilt offering that pictures Christ's recompensing work. I had to work really hard to come up with recompensing. That word really just means that it paid back what we owed. It paid back what was rightly due. Here are the circumstances. Look at Leviticus chapter 5, verse 15, first of all. If a person acts unfaithfully and sins unintentionally against the Lord's holy things, then he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock. Down in chapter 6, verses 1 through 3, he gives a couple of other instances where someone would bring a guilt offering. And this is where he fails to properly render what is due to the Lord, or if he benefits financially by fraud or by taking advantage of someone. So in other words, if somebody didn't bring the offering that he should have brought, if someone didn't tithe as he should have tithed, if someone defrauded the Lord by not giving to the support of the tabernacle as he should have, or if someone defrauded someone else and gained financially for it, he cheated somebody out of some money or out of some possessions, or he said, yeah, I'll keep this for you in trust so that when you come back, you can have it back and it's yours, and then that guy comes back and he says, no, this is really mine. So this guy gains financially from this sin in some way, shape, or form. He would bring this guilt offering. And the key concept that we're going to see in this guilt offering is that repayment is made. That debt is accrued through sin, and that in this offering, that debt is paid. There is only one acceptable animal to be brought for this guilt offering, and we see that in chapter 5, verse 15. He is to bring a ram without blemish, without defect from the flock, according to your valuation in silver by shekels. In other words, whatever it is that you should have brought to the temple that you didn't, you're going to bring a lamb that is worth at least that much in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary for the guilt offering. And before he can bring that offering, though, he has to go and do something else. Look at verse 16. He shall make restitution. He shall make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and he shall add to it a fifth part of it and give it to the priest. So in other words, the standard for this is going to be you are going to give back what you took plus 20% in order to make restitution for the sin that you have committed. In the middle of verse 16 picks up and says, the priest shall then make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and it shall be forgiven him. It shall be forgiven him. Come down to chapter 6 and verse 4. It shall be then, and this is basically the same thing over, it shall be then that if he sins and becomes guilty, that he shall restore what he took by robbery, or what he got by extortion, or the deposit which was entrusted to him, or the lost thing which he found, or anything about which he swore falsely, he shall make restitution for it in full, and add to it one-fifth more, and he shall give it to the one to whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering. Then he shall bring to the priest his guilt offering to the Lord, a ram without defect from the flock, according to your valuation, for a guilt offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord. He shall be forgiven for any one of the things which he may have done to incur guilt. So he is to bring it to the priest. The priest slays the offering, and the priest here is the one who makes the sacrifice. He burns the fatty portions on the altar. And one of the things that we see, God provides for the priests through this offering. Any of the priests who were ministering at the tabernacle were then able to or allowed to eat meat from this ram. So as this one makes restitution for the wrong that he's done, this worshiper makes restitution, the priests are provided for in this as well. But what happens in this offering? First, we see in verse 5, he makes restitution. He pays back the debt that he owed because of his sin. And in light of that then, in light of the sacrifice that's been made, in verse 7, he can secure atonement. Reconciliation is accomplished between God and the worshiper, and he is forgiven his guilt. The fact that he had acted in breach with the law will not be held against him because of this sacrifice. This pictures for us even today. So we understand the bigger reality in this, that as God's creation, we owe God our complete allegiance. And to sin is to deny that rightful relationship, and it fractures that relationship. Failure to obey God, failure to demonstrate our allegiance to God, it incurs a debt that we cannot possibly pay. What does Romans 6:23 says? The wages of sin, what we earn by sin is death. Is separation from God and his punishment. This is the debt that we owe because of our sin. We need restitution to be made for that debt. We need our guilt to be forgiven, and we need our relationship to be restored. Turn to Colossians chapter 2, and we see that Christ has accomplished this in his work on the cross. Colossians chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. I love this picture. demonstrate that when Christ died on the cross, he took our debt and he took the certificate of debt that stood against us and he nailed it to the cross. When you were dead, Colossians chapter 2, verse 13, in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us. The picture here is that we have failed to live up to the standard that God has set for us. We have accrued a debt, and there is a certificate of that debt that states that this is what we owe God. And he has canceled it out. He has marked on that statement, paid in full, having nailed it to the cross. He has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. When Jesus Christ died on the cross, he took the debt that we owed. He paid it himself. The debt that we owed of death, the debt we owed of God's wrath, the debt that we owed of being separated from God, not in a right relationship with him. Jesus Christ died and he paid that debt. Drank the dregs of God's wrath to its fullest in our place so that he could take the certificate of debt against us and say, I paid it. I've taken it out of the way. These individuals who are identified with me in my death can be atoned for, have been atoned for. The relationship can be made right. So in the guilt offering, we picture, we see the recompensing work of Jesus Christ. Finally, Fourthly, and this is my favorite offering of all of them, we see the peace offering that pictures Christ's fellowshipping work. We see the peace offering that pictures Christ's fellowshipping work. And in the peace offering, the key concept, the key idea here is going to be the fact that the worshiper, through the sacrifices that have been made, can come and enjoy fellowship with the God of the universe. This is so cool, the way that God set this up to demonstrate this. Come back to Leviticus and look at chapter 7. Verses 15 and 16 give us the circumstances of this offering. Now, as for the flesh of the sacrifices, thanksgiving peace offerings, it shall be eaten on the day of the offering, and it shall not leave any of it over until the morning. But if the sacrifice of his offering is a votive or a free will offering, it shall be eaten on the day that he offers the sacrifice. We're going to see these verses again, but what I want you to see there are the thanksgiving idea, the votive, and the free will idea. This sacrifice is unique in that we are not going to see any reference here to defilement or to sin. Instead, the offerer would bring this thanksgiving offering, this peace offering, when he recognized the good work of God in his life. He would bring that thanksgiving offering that he talks about in verse 15 when he simply wanted to express thanks for the Lord's work, for what he had done in his life. That votive offering, when he had made a vow, he said, God, if you do this, then I will bring you this offering. Then he would come and he would bring this offering. The free will offering says, hey, God is good, and he has done this good thing in my life, so I want to go, and I want to enjoy fellowship with the Lord at the tabernacle. This was an act of homage. It was freely given to God. It was brought because the offerer wanted to bring it, wanted to express the fellowship that he enjoyed with the Lord. The acceptable animals here, he could bring a male or female, cow, sheep, or goat. Here's the widest range of possible offerings, probably because this is an offering that's brought the most at the worshiper's discretion. He says, this is what I want to bring. You probably have the smaller animals, though, excluded here. You'll note that the turtle doves and the pigeons are not a part of this because there's not enough meat there then to enjoy the fellowship offering that is the culmination of this offering. Now come back to chapter 3. And pick up in verse 6, and we're going to see the process of this offering. We're going to skip to chapter 7 here in just a second. But in chapter 3, verse 6, we see this. If his offering is a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, if it's from the flock, he shall offer it a male or female without defect. If he is going to offer a lamb for his offering, then he shall offer it before the Lord, and he shall lay his hand on the head of the offering. He shall slay it before the tent of meeting, and Aaron's sons shall sprinkle its blood around on the altar. So if they sprinkle the blood around. From the sacrifice of the peace offerings, he shall bring as an offering by fire to the Lord its fat. the entire fat tail, which he shall remove close to the backbone, and the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys, again with the fat that is on them. Remember what we said about the fat portion of the offering? It was used for a lot of different things in society, and so it was thought of as the most valuable, the most important part of the animal. It was used as fuel for fire. It was used for livestock purposes. It was used for lots of different things. So that fat is offered up, and he'll remove it with the kidneys in verse 10. And the priest in verse 11 shall offer it up in smoke on the altar as food, an offering by fire to the Lord. Now, we've seen these fatty portions be offered up before, and what did that make for the Lord? That made a soothing aroma, right? An interesting statement here. It's different from any of the other offerings. It's a different picture from any of the other offerings. Why is he offering the fat portions here? He's offering it as food. Now you may say, that's strange. Some of the pagan worshipers, some of the pagan gods, when they brought their offerings, they often thought of the offering being an offering of food to their false gods, to their idols. But here, just one of these offerings is brought as food. And this makes much more sense when we skip over to chapter 7. Look at verse 15. Now, as for the flesh of the sacrifice of this thanksgiving peace offerings, it shall be eaten on the day of his offering. And he shall not leave any of it over until morning. But if the sacrifice of his offering is a votive or a free will offering, it will be eaten on the day that he offers his sacrifice. And the next day, what is left of it may be eaten. But what is left over from the flesh of the sacrifice on the third day shall be burned with fire. So if any of the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering should ever be eaten on the third day, he who offers it shall not be accepted, and it shall not be reckoned to his benefit. It shall be an offensive thing, and the person who eats it shall bear his own iniquity. But what you see here that's different from all of the other offerings is that the worshiper, the one who brings the offering, is allowed to do what? He's allowed to eat the offering. He's allowed to cook the meat, and he is allowed to partake in this. We've seen the priest be able to partake in the offering and the meat from that offering, but never the worshiper. And this brings together this idea of the fatty portion being offered to God as food, and now the worshiper is able to eat. What are God and the worshiper doing here? They're sharing a meal, right? They're eating together. And what greater, through the history of humankind, what greater picture of fellowship is there than to sit down and eat a meal together? In the ancient Near East, if you brought someone into your home and you fed them, you ate with them, you took on all sorts of responsibility to protect them and to provide for them and to enjoy fellowship with them. Today, we want to get together with other believers and we want to enjoy their company and their fellowship. We call them up and we invite them over for dinner, right? Even we see this in church discipline. What are you not allowed to do with someone on church discipline? Have a meal with them. The picture here is that the way has been provided through the sacrifices to enjoy fellowship, personal fellowship between the worshiper and the God of the universe. These sacrifices have provided the way for us to enjoy fellowship. They're sharing a meal together. Now, it should be noted, it seems that this peace offering is the culmination of the sacrifices. Talks about in the instructions for burning the fat portions that they were supposed to burn the fat portions of the peace offering on top of the burnt offering. So that burnt offering, logically what? Had to go before you could make a peace offering. And it seems also that if you wanted to make a burnt offering, that if you needed to make a sin offering or a guilt offering, that had to be done first. So we see that this peace offering is the culmination of the sacrificial system in the Old Testament. And we see that through these offerings, through these sacrifices, the worshiper could, as the name of offering and sacrifice suggests, could draw near to the Lord and enjoy fellowship with him through these sacrifices. The worshipers were able to express their fellowship with the Lord by sharing a fellowship meal with him. It should be noted that even as they enjoy this fellowship meal with him, that there is a strong note of consecration here. There are very strict rules for when and where you could eat the fellowship meal. So there is never, despite the fact that there is an intimate fellowship enjoyed here, that there is a sweet, sweet time of togetherness with the Lord, it should never be missed that any of that time spent in fellowship with the Lord does not breed a commonness about that. That we still, when we go into the presence of God, when the ancient Israelite went into the presence of God and enjoyed this fellowship meal at the tabernacle, that he had to be ritually pure. This was not something that made God common. It was a calling that allowed us to come into the presence of the holy. It was a calling that allowed them to come into the presence of the holy God who was different, who was other. But through the sacrifices, he had made provision for them to come into his presence. Here's what we learn again. Here is how this antitype works out. We see that this sacrifice is unusual because there's no mention of cleansing, atonement, or recompense throughout. This sacrifice, in my mind, represents the pinnacle of life. That is enjoying fellowship with their Creator. What did Jesus Christ say is the ultimate in life? What did he say is the very definition of life? In John 17:3, he says, "This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." And this sacrifice, this peace offering, demonstrated in very tangible terms the enjoyment of that fellowship. Man's ultimate need, what man needs more than anything else in the entire world, is to enjoy true life in fellowship with his Creator. That's what we were made for. And where this sacrifice, this peace offering, could not do that ultimately, and we even see that in the limited time that that fellowship offering was good, and in the limited space where you could enjoy this fellowship offering and the fellowship that it afforded with the Creator, this sacrifice could never really fully pave the way for us to go into the presence of God. There is a sacrifice that will allow us to enjoy fellowship with God, and that fellowship that we were made for by permanently paving the way into the presence of our God, and that is the offering of Jesus Christ. Turn to Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 through 18. He's talking about the bringing into unity between the Gentile and the Jew and the church. But he's talking about the fact that the enmity that existed between the Gentile and the Jew has been done away with because we can now all come into the presence of God through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Therefore, Ephesians 2:11, remember that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who were called uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision which is performed in the flesh by human hands. Remember that you were at that time separate from Christ, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope without God in the world, but now in Christ Jesus, you who formerly were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of the commandments contained in ordinances, so that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both in one body to God through the cross by having put to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were far away and peace to those who were near, for through him we both have our access in one spirit to the Father. How can we come into the presence of God every single day? How are we welcomed into God's presence everywhere we are? It is through the person and work of Jesus Christ in his death and resurrection, his sacrificial death on our behalf. As we draw to a close tonight, I want to remind you of the necessity to recognize what Christ has done on your behalf. And we see in these very tangible pictures of what it is that Christ has accomplished. Understand that the burnt offering teaches us that you on your own are not set apart from sin, much less the mundane. You are separated from God, and that Christ gave himself wholly so that you could be set apart to him. Understand that in the sin offering, we see that you on your own, you are defiled and guilty because of your sin. You are dirty and qualified for God's wrath, not for his presence. And because Jesus Christ shed his blood, you can be cleansed of your defilement and forgiven of your guilt and enter into his holy presence. Understand that on your own, your sin has accrued a debt that you cannot possibly pay. Understand that you have earned God's wrath, separation from him forever in hell. But Christ took the certificate of debt against you and stamped the words "paid in full" on that certificate when he nailed it to the cross. Understand that on your own you are separate, you are excluded, you are a stranger, you are without hope, you are without God in the world, you are truly living a life of living death. But Christ died to sanctify you, to redeem you, so that you could walk every moment of every day in his glorious presence. Also understand that if you sit here tonight and you reject the sacrifice that has been made on your behalf in the person and work of Jesus Christ, that nothing remains for you except the terrifying expectation of judgment for your selfishness, for your defilement, for the debt that you owe, for your separation from God. Let's pray. Father, the sacrifice of your Son is something truly wonderful to behold. Terrible at the same time, but Father, what it has accomplished for us is unfathomable. You have given us pictures in what you required of the nation Israel and the sacrificial system. Father, I pray that those pictures would help us to think more deeply and more accurately of what your Son did when he gave himself as the ultimate sacrifice on the cross. Pray, Father, that we would be faithful as believers to live in light of the fact that we have been ushered into your glorious presence always, everywhere we go, not just in the tabernacle confines, not just at a certain time of year, not just for a few days' time, but every moment of every day, that we live in your presence because of what your Son has done. Lord, you tell us many times in your word that is to motivate us to be holy and to live a life that is pleasing to you. I pray that would be true of us. Father, for those who are here who have rejected you, who have rejected the Son that you have sent, who have rejected the sacrifice that he has made and regarded as nothing more than common, unclean. Lord, I pray your mercy on them, that you would bring them to a place where they recognize their need for your Son and the sacrifice and provision that he has made. We pray these things in your Son's precious name. Amen.